good to be here. Thanks for inviting me down here. This is what I really like doing. It's what I intend to spend the rest of my life doing. And I wanted to do it all along, but with a lot of mouths to feed, you had to make a lot of money. And so I did. I finally got to the point 3 years ago I could walk away from the corporate job and come do this. And my first year income was exactly 5% of what my income was the year before. And my wife said, why are we doing this again? Because, like, we still have a mortgage. It's like, it'll work out, honey. Trust me. So, and then I made $10,000 more last year than the year before. All right, so listen, I like to think in terms of headlines, all right? And this is the headline for the talk tonight. It's a simple thing to be happily married, but that doesn't make it easy, all right? Simple just means the stuff that really happy couples do well isn't that much different from what the unhappy couples do. I mean, there's not, you don't need a PhD to get this marriage thing right, okay? But it's kind of hard. It's kind of like, I liken it to losing weight. Losing weight is really simple. Yeah, eat less. I mean, that's it, right? If you just eat 100 calories less a day, you're going to lose weight, right? But try doing it. Try just 100 less calories a day, much less 500 or something. So, but that's kind of what marriage is all about, all right? So what we're going to talk about today is how to manage conflict. Is there anybody here whose marriage does not have conflict? Good. So, but this reminds me of one of my favorite Bishop Sheen stories. And he was talking to a bunch of couples, and he said, is there any man here who thinks he actually is the head of his home? And after about 30 seconds, a man stood up in the back. And he said, sir, is that true? Do you really think you're the head of your home? And the man said, no, my wife told me to stand up. All right, so if you don't think you have conflict, you need more intensive psychotherapy because we are all flawed, right? We all have defects. We come into this world with original sin. And along the way, we pick up a few other bad habits, like we become impatient and we develop anger and, we get selfish and, and so we have conflict. Conflict cannot be avoided, so it has to be managed. The problem is we don't know how to manage it because no one taught us. And so our role model for how to handle conflict is how our parents did it. They probably didn't do too good of a job. I know my parents didn't do a good job of it, right? Because nobody taught them how to handle it either. Another headline. It's not conflict that causes problems in marriage. It's conflict avoidance. But we don't talk about the things that upset us because, yeah, I don't want to start a fight. I don't want to start an argument. So I just shut up. I'll just take it. I'm supposed to carry my cross. You are my cross, right? So I just have to deal with you. So I'm just not going to deal. But what happens is it builds and it builds and it builds until finally it explodes, right? So I had a couple I was working with. Both lived in suburban Chicago. They both worked downtown. They rode the train together each day to go to work. He comes in the kitchen one morning to put his shoes on. Her backpack is on the chair. He takes it. He sets it on the floor. He sits down. He puts his shoes on. She comes in, sees the backpack on the floor, and loses it. Starts screaming at him. So what's going on, right? It can't be the fact that the backpack, right? But she said, that's always the way it is with you. Everything I do, you have to redo it. You have to fix everything I do. You rearranged the Civil War drawer last week. He's like, yeah, but I made it better, right? So, but all these things were just building up. Finally, it came out because he moved the backpack actually 12 inches, right? So, we don't want to do that. We want to be able to handle conflict in an easy way. Here's the deal. This might depress you. 70% of all conflicts in marriages cannot be fixed. 30% of your conflicts you can resolve. 70% you're not going to resolve, okay? Because it's endemic in who you are, right? You're an extrovert and she's an introvert. Well, okay, you're just not going to resolve that, right? You're a morning person and your husband's a night owl. You're not going to fix it, but that's going to lead to some conflict because you're ready to go to bed and they're like, what do you mean? It's 9 o'clock. I got 3 more good hours. No, come to bed. I'll be there in 3 hours. No, I'll be there. I'm coming. I'm on my way, right? So a lot of these problems you're just not going to resolve. Okay. And that's where our faith comes in, right? And I'll talk more about that in a little bit, okay? The good thing is, you don't have to solve all the problems to have a happy marriage. You just have to know how to resolve the ones that you can and do that in a kind and a gentle way. So one of the leading marriage therapists in the country is a guy named Dan Weil. And so I copied down just a couple paragraphs out of his book. And I think it's pretty instructive. It says, when choosing a partner, you are inevitably choosing a particular set of unsolvable problems that you will be living with forever. Marriages are successful to the degree that the problems you choose are ones you can live with. Too late for you all, because you already made it. This goes over better when I'm working with the engaged couples. Paul married Alice, and Alice gets loud at parties, and Paul, who is shy, hates that. But if Paul had married Susan, he and Susan would have gotten into a fight before they even got to the party. That's because Paul is always late, and Susan hates to be kept waiting. She would feel taken for granted, which she's very sensitive about. Paul would see her complaining about this as her attempt to dominate him, which he's very sensitive about. Paul married Gail, they wouldn't even have gone to the party because they would still be upset about the argument they had the day before about Paul's not helping with the housework. Same is true about Alice. If she had married Steve, and he kind of goes on and on, right? So no matter, the temptations think, oh, well, if I married somebody else, they would actually think I'm funny, or they wouldn't, you know. No, you know, no matter who you married a defective person. So you just got to get used to it, all right? So here's the thought, and this is where our faith comes in. We are perfected through our spouse's imperfections. Okay? We are perfected through our spouse's imperfections. Or as my wife likes to say, she never says she. She says, he who irritates sanctifies. So she'll often say, oh, you're sanctifying me now. All right, that's my job, is to get you into heaven. I know exactly what buttons to push to do that. So that's the deal, right? So God often gives us a spouse that we most need to help us grow in whatever virtues we most need. So if we lack patience, God may give us a spouse who tends to be late a lot, okay? If we tend to be miserly, God may give us a spouse who likes to spend money, all right? So oftentimes, realize that the fact that you're married, this is who God wanted you to go through life with, blemishes and all. And those areas of conflict where we're not getting along are opportunities to grow in patience, are opportunities to grow in just about any virtue you want, okay? Because marriage really is the proving ground for all of the virtues, because there is no one in the world that you're as close to, no one in the world you are as vulnerable with, no one in the world who you've given your entire self to, as John Paul talked about, the total gift of self. So no one can hurt you as much as the person you marry, because you're not as vulnerable with anybody else. And you will hurt each other because you're flawed and you get defects. So when that happens, 99 times out of 100, it's not intentional. You don't wake up in the morning thinking, how can I irritate my wife today? Oh, that's what I'll do first, right? That's not what you do. But half the time before breakfast is over, you've done something that has irritated your wife. So, you know, how do we deal with all that, right? So the basic strategy, I think, is to accept your spouse's personality, because you really aren't going to change it, right? So you got to accept it. All right, so I want you to think about marriage perhaps in a way you've never thought about it before. Okay, and to do that, I'm going to use, some of you might know this, is this called the infinity loop? Some of you know what that is, right? You get on, and there aren't any off-ramps. Around and around and around you go. Okay. On this side, we'll put the husband. On this side, the wife. On top, we'll put behaviors. And on the bottom, we put emotions. Okay. It's a closed loop, right? So behaviors trigger emotions. All behaviors will trigger an emotion, every time. Emotions drive behaviors, which then trigger an emotion, which then drives a behavior, and off you go. Okay? So, ladies, let's say your husband comes home on Tuesday night and brings you flowers. Flowers. What's the emotion? Happy? I'm liking that, right? I'm happy. Flowers make me feel very good. When you are happy with your husband, what are you likely to do? Well, all right, we got a problem here. You might hug him. You might smile him. You might give him a longer kiss. You might just, Yeah, you're going to be nice to him. Gentlemen, when your wife hugs you and gives you a longer kiss, how do you feel?
Super.
How do you know? She, they've been married so long, she knows what he's going to say before he says it. All right, but you're feeling pretty good about that, right? So I gave a talk last week at my wife and my own daughter teach at the Willows in Chicago, which is an all-girls school. And I said to the, so I was talking to the high school girls about how to date and how to pick a good boy to marry, somebody, that kind of thing. And I said to them, "You want to make a boy faint?" Like, yeah. So just go up to that boy, you smile at him, and you wink at him. He will go right down. I promise, right? Gentlemen, when she smiles at you and winks at you, you're going to have a very positive emotional reaction, right? So now you're feeling pretty good because she hugged you, kissed you, and told you she loved you. What are you going to do? More flowers. Yeah. I'll be right back, honey. I'm going back to the store. But right, you're more likely to help with the dishes. You're more likely to tell her how pretty she's looking tonight. And you are off now to a very good evening, right? This is a pretty good deal. Of course, we can't afford flowers every night. One of the things I'll talk to the guys about tomorrow is a thing called love maps. And love maps is an indication of how well you actually know your wife. And I've got a little worksheet I'll pass out. And there's one question in there. It's when my wife and I did it, there's one question: what's your wife's favorite flowers? And I decided it was whatever was on sale at the grocery store. Because that's what I buy. Right? I can't afford a dozen roses. I buy what's on sale. All right. So now we're off to a good start. Let's change the scenario. He comes home an hour late and doesn't call. How are you feeling now, ladies?
Irritated,
upset, angry. When you are irritated, upset, and angry at that boy, what might you do? You might ignore him. Might give him a cold shoulder, right? He comes in to kiss you, and you're like, right there, right? Right. So you're going to ignore him, okay? Gentlemen, when you come in the house and she ignores you, how do you feel?
Ignored.
You feel ignored. And the emotion would be? Anger, irritation, frustration. When you are angry, irritated, frustrated at your wife, what might you do?
Sport pages.
You might go to the sport pages. What if they're oblivious? Well, they could. That's a different issue, right? We'll work on that tomorrow. Right? But you being a guy, right, what do? We solve problems. We'd say, what's wrong with you? Right? What's your problem? I'm home, right? So when he says, what's your problem? What? Now you're emotional. Now you're even more irritated.
Yeah.
Now you're like, really? Now I'm throwing frying pans. And now we're off to a very bad start, right? This is not going to go well, okay? So anytime you do anything, your spouse is going to have an emotional reaction. And the idea is to do more positive things than negative things, all right? But it's not just as simple as that. It's a little more difficult. There's something that happens in here, in this space from emotion to behavior. It's very scientific. You know what we call this right here?
Choice.
Zero.
We call this thinking. And you start thinking, has he ever done anything dumb like that before? Oh, yeah, he sure has. He was rude the other day. In fact, we got in the car. He didn't even open the car door for me. Well, I remember 2 years ago, he said something rude to his mother. In fact, back when we were dating. Right? So all of a sudden you start thinking about all the other times he was late or didn't call or was inconsiderate. And now stuff that happened 5 and 10 years ago drops right into the present. So now I'm even more worked up than I was before. So not just about the fact that you came home tonight and didn't call. It's about all the bad things you've done the entire time you've been married. And then it kind of explodes. It's kind of like the whole backpack thing, right? It just gets out of control. Make sense? You ever think about it like that? Pretty cool. All right. So that's point number one. Point number two, I want to talk about needs and fears. For the woman and the man. What is a woman's greatest need? Now, generally speaking. There are exceptions, of course.
To be loved.
Correct. A woman's greatest need is to be loved. And what's a man's greatest need?
Respect.
To be respected. You've read the book. Respect. Right. Respect. What's a woman's greatest fear?
To be abandoned.
To be abandoned, to be alone, to be pushed aside, to be told she's not important. Abandoned. And a man's greatest fear?
To fail.
Is failure. We hate failure more than anything. Which is why we are so competitive, right? In sports, at work, at every red light we pull up to. Right? You ever notice? Right? You're there at the red light, and there's a guy next to you, and you're looking, it's who's going to, when that light turns, who's going to get through the next section first? And you're both in minivans. We're going to drag race minivans? Really? That's what. But if it's women, they're kind of like, no, you can go. Right? So we're so competitive. So we hate feel like a failure, and we need respect. Right? But when we mess up, we fail. All right? So what happened now in our scenario where the husband comes home late? Why, ladies, are you upset? Yeah, you're feeling abandoned. You feel like I'm not important. If I was important, you would have called. Right? So that's what's happening. This deal about, boy, I'm not important anymore. You would have called. There was a time when you would have called. Now you don't. I feel like I'm not too important in your life anymore. So then when you point that out to him, you knucklehead, you came home late, you didn't call. Why am I getting upset now? It's true. But now I failed. I failed doing what a good husband would do. A good husband would have called. I didn't do it. But I don't like feeling like a failure. So now I'm going to get irritated and say, oh, yeah? Well, you ain't all that good either. You were late the other day. Kids got to school late. They got it. Whatever it is. Right? What you will find is, in the majority of your conflicts, generally, one of these four buttons got pushed. Now, this doesn't mean that women don't want to be respected and that men don't need to be loved. And it doesn't mean that women are okay failing or that men don't feel abandoned. We do. But it just means women are going to be a little more sensitive to anything you perceive to be unloving or that dismisses you. And men will be a little more sensitive to anything they feel is disrespectful or that's suggesting we're failures. Okay? And sometimes it flips. You know, I'm working with couples sometimes, and a woman's like, yeah, I don't care about that. And man is, oh, that really bothers me a lot. I really need a lot of connection, and I'm not getting my feel bad. But generally speaking, okay? But what's happening in your conflicts, generally, one of these four buttons is getting pushed. And that's why you're getting escalated. Okay, that's why you get upset. Okay? So it gets even a little more complicated than that. There are four things, and luckily only four, because you keep track of four things, that are highly predictive of marital disharmony. And if they're present at a high level, they're very predictive of divorce. Okay. And they are called, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And I cannot spell apocalypse. And they're called the four horsemen of the apocalypse because when they show up, they bring with them death and destruction. I mean, all chaos ensues. Okay. So the first one is criticism. Okay. We know what criticism is, right? That's when I point out what's wrong with you, because obviously you don't know. And if I can just point out what's wrong with you, then of course you will change. And if you change, then I'll be happy, right? So really, not so much I care about you know, you being the best version of yourself you can be. It's because you're bugging me, and you need to change, right? So criticism, number one. Number two is contempt. Okay. So contempt is, I mean, the best way to think about contempt is it's mean-spirited criticism. Contempt is where I'm now. I'm trying to hurt you. Okay, verbally, now I'm getting pretty hurtful. I'm poking you in the ribs. This is where name calling comes in, devaluing. You know, my mother told me not to marry you. I should have listened to my mother. And the other place where contempt comes in is when you start using the words always or never. You know, you never call when you're late. You always leave your shoes in the middle of the floor. You know, always and never. So it's just, this is the most harmful and the most predictive of divorce because it cuts the most. Because now there's an intentionality here. I can always say in the criticism, I'm just trying to help you. But when I get to contempt, now I'm not trying to help anymore. Now I'm just angry and I'm trying to hurt you. Okay. Three is stonewalling. Okay, stonewalling is when I just shut down. I'm not having this fight anymore, and then you walk away, you just shut down. Okay. Obviously, you can't solve a problem if you don't engage in the conversation about it. So 70% of the couples, what happens is it's a situation called pursue and withdraw, where the man tends to withdraw, he shuts down, he leaves, and the woman pursues. So when the man just shuts down and stops engaging in the conflict, ladies, how do you feel? Feeling abandoned. Wait a minute, come back here. We're not done yet. Oh, yes, we are. No, we're not. So in the first year of our marriage, maybe the first 2 years, we'd get in an argument about something, and I would shut down. I'd walk away. She'd say, come back. We got to resolve this. I'm like, no, we don't. Yes, we do. No, we don't. And I'd walk away up the stairs into the bedroom, around the bed, down the stairs. She'd follow me all around out to the garage. And we'd get away from me. I can't deal with this anymore. You got to stop. She'd say, no, we got, you know, I had no idea about this stuff going on. But she was feeling abandoned. I'm like, no, I got to get out of here. Now, men tend to stonewall a lot more than women, okay? The reason is we tend to escalate physiologically much more quickly than women. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, doctor. But you take two newborns, a boy and a girl, you put them side by side and you slam a door, the boy will jump and the girl will not. We are hardwired from the day we're born to respond to threats and danger more quickly and rapidly than women are. That's how we're wired. Yes?
You haven't heard that?
Well, do some research. Try that. Tomorrow when you get into the office.
Some of my parents are here. I better not.
just try it. Yeah. So, but we're hardwired to respond, right? And so we tend to escalate much more quickly. Generally speaking, sometimes women escalate very quickly as well. Okay, but generally speaking, we tend to escalate more quickly. And when we escalate, now here's... Once your heart rate gets above about 90 beats per minute, and that's not that high, you've lost your ability to be rational. Okay, so you can no longer think rationally. And I actually have a couple of pulse oximeters. And if I have couples that fight a lot, I'll see here, put these on. Now go ahead and tell me about last night's fight. And as they start escalating, I'm like, okay, where's your pulse? Where's your pulse? Where's your pulse? They're like, 95. Okay, you got to stop. Oh, no, I'm just getting going. Yeah, no, this is when you got to stop. Because once you've lost your ability to be rational, now you're just going to hurt each other. Now you're just going to fall into contempt. Okay. So men, when we escalate, that puts us into fight or flight. And I don't want to fight you, so I'm just going to get out of there. But that leaves you feeling abandoned, ladies, right? So the solution to the problem, because when you get there, you have to stop because you're just going to do damage. But the solution is say, I need to take a break now. I need to call a timeout. But I will come back in 15 minutes or in an hour. But I will come back. Then your wives aren't going to be feeling abandoned. Because it's like, okay, we're going to get it resolved. I got it. You're upset. You're angry. You need to take a walk. I'm good with that. Okay. Sometimes you're going to say, I'm just so angry right now. I can't deal with this tonight. We're going to have to pick it up tomorrow. And that's okay. And then you go to bed and you still hold each other and you hug each other and you love each other because you do. But I'm still angry, but we'll get it resolved tomorrow. So you can call the timeout, okay? Now, I recommend that couples have a code word. And the code word is, whenever you say the code word, that means we're taking a timeout. And you have to honor the code word. Whoever says the code word, the other one's got to stop, okay? So with my wife and I, the code word is spinach. Why spinach, you might ask? Because I really like spinach. But spinach is not good for me because spinach is high in oxalates. Oxalates produce kidney stones. I've had two kidney stones. I don't want any more kidney stones. The stories I could tell. All right? So spinach is the code word. Because when I'm angry, which is easy for me, I really want to go at it. But that's not good for anybody when Doug's angry and he's yelling. Okay? So spinach is the code word. But you've got to honor the code word. So when your spouse says spinach or whatever your code word is, you got to stop. Okay? Now, these days, normally, now for every 10 times the word spinach is said in my home, it's 9 times that my wife utters it and 1 time that I say it. Normally, it's when I'm getting on one of my kids' case for something, like they blew curfew or something. Then I'm letting them have it. And she'll come in and she'll say, spinach. Really? Because I'm just getting going, you know? And every once in a while, like, she'll be gone, and the kid will get into trouble. And they'll say, hey, Dad, spinach. I'm like, oh, no, 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 no. Your mother is the only one who gets to play the spinach card, son. And she's not here. Fasten your seatbelt. Because I'm not happy with you. So, the password's a very important thing, okay? So we just got to shut it down and come back. So you honor the password, okay? That's the deal. Okay, and then the last one is defensiveness. Defensiveness, right? It's not my fault, it's your fault. Pretty simple. I got drunk last night because you made me mad. Quit making me mad, I'll quit drinking. As much. Right? Obviously, you can't solve the problem if you don't own your piece of it. Right? But we get defensive. Especially guys, because, man, I don't want to be... Let me tell you why this was not a failure on my part. See, it's not my fault. Because there was traffic, you know, and then the boss was talking to me, and then... You know, actually, I stopped at a store. I was going to buy you flowers, but they were sold out. And you know, so I'm really not a failure, right? So I get really defensive trying to protect my ego. And if you tell me about my failures loud enough or angry enough, then I'm feeling disrespected too. So I'm going to kind of go the defensive route. Now, women get defensive as well, of course, when men attack women. But I can't solve anything when I get defensive. Okay? So the antidote to defensiveness is... Seek first to understand before you seek to be understood, right? So when my wife and I get arguments, she says, well, you always think you're right. Well, duh. Of course I think I'm right. I'm not going to sit here and think, what's the wrong answer? That's the one I'm going to argue, right? Of course I think I'm right. And I want to just make sure you know I'm right so then you can stop. But she thinks she's right, right? So the deal is, help me understand why you think this. Help me understand your position on this. Why are you upset about this? What is it? So the more I can seek to understand where you're coming from, the easier it is to resolve the issue. But the problem is I just want to get my opinion out first. You know, so we get defensive. I'm going to keep telling you why you're wrong. But I don't even know why you feel the way you feel. I just know it's the wrong way to feel because I don't feel that way. I'm not feeling that way, so why are you? So defensiveness, seek first to understand. And when I work with couples, we spend a lot of time on that because, you know, when they first come in to see me, generally they're not getting along too well. And the first session, they're doing this, right? They're just saying, hey, Doug, let me tell you what's wrong with my wife. You get her straightened out, I'm going to be just fine. And she's saying, let me tell you about my knuckleheaded husband. You fix him, and I'm going to be just fine. So they're telling me what's wrong with each other. Got it. They got their problems. But therapy doesn't start until you start pointing at yourself. So, okay, here, now I know how I'm contributing to the disharmony in the marriage. Here's what I'm doing. And how can I stop doing this bad thing and start doing the opposite, right? So, we spend a lot of time with the couples helping them ask each other questions to help them understand at a deeper level why the other person's upset. So seek first to understand. You'll have plenty of time to get your opinion out there later, okay? So just try to really understand. Okay? Make sense? Mm-hmm. So, so here's the problem, right? We're pretty flawed, we're pretty defective. We do things a lot unintentionally, but that irritate our spouses, and then they tell us that, and off we go. I'm constantly doing things that do not convey love or respect, and that suggest that I should be a man, or I'm a failure. And then I get riled up, and I climb on one of these horses. And then we do battle on horseback, right? So, right? How do you fix that? So this is the diagram of what goes on whenever you have an argument or conflict. Right? Pretty close. How are you going to fix that? You have to invite me back next time.
You have to use that think.
You have to use this think thing.
Yeah.
The thinking thing is kind of important, right? So the other thing I should point out is this here, that's the devil's playground. That's where he gets inside your head and says, yeah, maybe you did marry a loser, right? Maybe you could have done better. Maybe. I mean, Satan hates marriage, I think, well, for probably a lot of reasons, but two in particular, I think. When he sees a husband and wife, he thinks Christ and his church, and he thinks what Christ did to him by coming down and dying to redeem us. And Christ often, you use the analogy, he's the bridegroom and the church is his bride, right? So he sees husband and wife, he thinks Christ church, and he hates that, right? That's the first thing. I think the second thing is when he sees husband, wife, and children, he thinks the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the love between them, and then the love between the husband and the wife that results in children. And he hates the Trinity, right? So he hates your marriage, and he's going to do everything he can do to pull it apart, and this is where he operates. This is where he shows up. He gets you thinking and thinking, and it's easy to drop into criticism and contempt. Okay, or stonewalling, like, yeah, same old story. I've been yelled at for that 27 times this month, right? So you got to realize he's not going to let up on this. In fact, I came across this, I was listening to a podcast just a few weeks ago, and they're talking about Sister Lucia, the third of the three seers from Fatima, I guess wrote a letter to John Paul II when he was Pope, saying she had some sort of revelation that Satan was going to focus on destroying marriage. That was going to be his focus going forward. Okay. Well, by the looks of things, he's had a fair amount of success. Right? I mean, the divorce rate's 50%, roughly. The divorce rate for second marriages is what?
80%.
66. Wow. 66. And third marriages? 75. So practice doesn't make perfect. So it ain't getting any better than what you got. So just fix what you got right now. Right? And now we don't even define marriage as a man and a woman. I mean, so now we've really undermined just the very foundation of what marriage is all about in this society. So Satan's had a pretty fair amount of success, I think, in trying to destroy marriages. Because if he can destroy the marriage, then he can destroy the kids. Because kids suffer a lot when marriages don't make it when they break up, okay? So this is where he operates a lot. So when your mind starts going to all the times in the past, you just got to say, get behind me, Satan. Stop it. I'm just not going there. I'm just going to deal with today's problem, and I'm forgetting about the rest. Okay. All right. So the solution to this is really very simple. In fact, it's almost too simple. And you're going to look at it and you're going to be like, really? That's it? Yeah. So I liken this to the Old Testament story of Naaman the Syrian. Remember Naaman? He was the top general in Syria, right? He had leprosy. And his wife's slave girl is an Israelite. Says, hey, we got this prophet, Isaiah. Was it Isaiah? Elijah. Elijah. Got this prophet Elijah. He can cure you. Really? Okay. Grabs his slave. They go over to see Elijah. Elijah doesn't even come out of the tent, sends his guy out and says, just go jump in the river seven times.
The Jordan.
And Naaman's like, what? And I think it says he went away and he was livid. I think livid was the translation, right? He was really angry. But his slave to him said to him, listen, if he'd asked you to do something really hard, you'd have done it, right? Yeah, well, how much more now that it's easy? All right, fine. Jumps in seven times, comes out, and his skin is like a small child, like a child's skin. Right? It was so simple, but it was really effective. And so that's what I'm going to give you right now. And it's called Gentle Startup. Okay. Because conflicts end the way they start. So if you wait till you're upset, it ain't gonna, the argument ain't going to calm down once you get going. It's only going to ratchet up, right? So if you can start in a gentle place, you got a much greater likelihood of ending in a gentle place. Three parts to this. In fact, I keep saying this, I haven't done it. I'm going to actually get this printed on a refrigerator magnet so I can give it to my couples and they can just put it on the refrigerator, because I believe it's, and if you don't remember anything all night, if you remember this, I promise you, your marriage will improve significantly. Starts off with the phrase, I feel. And you label your emotion. I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel frightened. I feel unloved, I feel disrespected, I feel abandoned, like I'm not important, or I feel like I'm a failure. I feel. You label the emotion, and that's difficult. Some people have a hard time really labeling how they're feeling. They just know they're not feeling good, but they can't put a word on it. So I actually have an emotion wheel I pass out to some of my couples. It lists like 72 emotions or something. But you got to label the emotion. You can't say, I feel like you're being a jerk. That's not it. That's here. Okay, we're not going there. Okay. All right. I feel like I'm not important. I'm feeling unloved. When you... Then you label the behavior. Okay? I feel like I'm not important to you when you come home late and you don't call. Okay? Third thing. And I'd like to ask you to please... And what you want the new behavior to look like. So, I feel like I'm not important to you when you come home an hour late and don't call. I'd like to ask you to please call if you can be more than 15 minutes late. That solved it pretty simply, right? And this actually comes from a true case. I had a couple, and they were fighting about this thing. And so we dove into it. The wife grew up in a home where the father worked in a factory. He got off work every night at 5 o'clock. He walked in the door every night at 5:30. If he wasn't home by 5:35, they started calling the hospitals because something had to be wrong. Right? That's the world she grew up in. He grew up, his dad had an outside sales job. So depending on where his last account was of the day, there was like an hour window when he would get home, and nobody thought anything about it. He had an hourly way. Her dad had 5 minutes. So she thought, so he's like, I got time, right? I'm not in any rush because I can stop off, do some shopping, I can do whatever I want to do, or I can just work late and I don't have to call. She thought it was because she wasn't loved. He's like, well, I adore you. I just didn't think I was supposed to call. So once we set it out like this, he's like, oh, I can do that. That's pretty easy, right? So what's happening is, I mean, everybody does the best they can with what they've got. He didn't think he was doing anything wrong. And she was really offended and hurt by it. He didn't know. So once they were able to talk about it, they got it straightened out. Make sense? I feel when you, and I'd like to ask you to please. Okay. So when I do my workshops, this is the point where the couples then start talking about some of their conflicts and they try to get them resolved like this. I promise 90% of your conflicts will get resolved in under 30 seconds without any hard feelings. So my wife and I kind of discovered this maybe 2.5 years ago, and this has become part of the actual lexicon of our marriage now. You'll hear us say this quite a lot. I'll give you a classic example. A couple months ago, upstairs in my office, working on some stuff, 10 o'clock in the morning, she brings me a cup of hot tea. I love hot tea. And I said to her, thank you for bringing me that hot tea. And she said, you're welcome. And she left. And she came back 10 minutes later. Now, the way my wife does it, she says, I would like to have a gentle conversation with you. So she walks in upstairs. She says, I'd like to have a gentle conversation with you. I'll give you a direct quote. I didn't say this out loud, but inside I said, shit. What? How did I get into trouble? I've been up here all day. She said, I felt unappreciated and a little disrespected when you thanked me for bringing you the tea, but you did not look up from your computer. Next time I'd like to ask you to look at me. And I'm like, damn. I said, you're really pretty. I like looking at you. I can do that really easy, right? So, but in the old days, what would have happened? She'd have gone downstairs. She'd have been upset. She just started thinking, has he ever been inconsiderate to me? Has he ever not looked at me before? Has he ever been, not had gratitude before? Only last week and the last month and back when we were dating 42 years ago. And I'd have come down for lunch and she'd have banged a couple pots or pans and she'd have been a little bit off and I'd have said, you okay? She'd have been like, yeah, why? Well, I don't know, you just seem a little off. No, I'm fine. Are you sure? I'm absolutely fine. Okay. We'd have had lunch, right? I'd have gone back upstairs. I'd have been doing my thing, working on my stuff. I'd have come down for dinner. There'd have been more pots banging, right? And she'd have been a little more, cold, a little more, like, here's the cheek kind of thing, right? And I'd have said, are you sure you're okay? Yeah, why? Well, you just don't seem right. Well, no, I'm fine, except that you're a rude, inconsiderate slob. But that's what would have happened in the old days, right? Because she'd have been thinking, it'd have been growing, right? And I'd have just gotten boom. So we solved this thing in literally, well, 10 minutes. Took her 10 minutes to decide to come back upstairs, right? In 30 seconds of conversation, we got it solved. Where in the old days, it would have ruined the whole day. And then half the night, because then I'd have said, well, I'm not a failure, because show me some respect. The whole night would have been ruined. And then she'd have been yelling spinach, and I'd have said, I'm not doing spinach tonight, I'm too mad. All right, so this is the deal right here. This is how you handle conflict. And couples that have really good marriages are able to handle conflict when they get hurt by each other in a way that says, I still love you, but I'm feeling hurt right now. And you did this thing. And I'd like to ask you to do a little different next time. And you get it resolved before it builds up. So you never have the backpack thing. It never gets to that point where one little thing makes me crazy, because we've handled all of the problems when they're kind of little before they build up. And you get a resolve kind of quickly, okay? Does that make sense? But you got to do it in this order. Because if you start off with number two, it comes across as criticism or contempt. So when you come home late, well, wait a minute, I didn't think I was late. I thought I had, an hour window here, right? So you got to start off with how I feel. Because the reason this works, because the foundation of this idea is, I really love you. I do not want to hurt you. And if I'm doing something that hurts you, I want to know about it so I can stop doing it. That's why this works. Because you tell me I'm doing something that's hurting you, but you're doing it in a gentle way, and you're talking about your heart first, which I want to protect your heart. I don't want to hurt you. So if I know I'm doing it, I'm like, wow, I want to know that, because I don't want to go around hurting you. Normally, sometimes. If you make me mad enough, I do. Right? So that's the basis. I love you. I don't want to hurt you. So if you can tell me how I'm hurting you, but in a way that doesn't leave me feeling unloved or disrespected or like a failure, that I'm not important. If you can tell to me and not trigger one of these, I'm going to be very receptive to that idea. Make sense? Cool. All right. This also brings me to the importance of safety in a relationship. Safety is one of the single most important things in a marriage. And not just physical safety, of course, but emotional safety. I've got to feel that you've got to feel that when you're inside here, when you're inside my arms, you are in the safest place in the world. Whatever happened out there all day long, you're safe now because you are here, all right? And I will never hurt you, at least not intentionally. I will hurt you a lot because I'm stupid a lot. But if you tell me, I'm going to say I'm sorry and I'm going to make it up to you. But I am never going to go here. You can count on that. I'm never going to go contempt. I'm never going to go name calling and trying to hurt you because I love you. So safety is really important because this puts you in a really vulnerable place. And I've had it happen in some of my sessions where, you know, I've had the husband say, hey, listen, I feel disrespected. And the wife will say, that's stupid. You shouldn't feel that stupid to feel that way. You're an idiot to feel that way. Whoa. Probably not going to have this conversation again until I get to divorce court, right? So you're really vulnerable when you say that, because you're really taking your heart out of your chest and you're saying, hey, you hurt me when you did this. And so safety is really an important thing. And so you have to, even if you don't necessarily agree, you've got to honor this, because feelings are yours. They're not wrong if they're yours, because they're yours. And so safety is really critical, because without safety, you can turn this into a baseball bat, and you can really hurt each other with it, right? Okay, so that's why safety is so critical. Okay. One of the things that happens is, and so I spend a lot of time with couples figuring out what are they doing that's hurting each other. And one of the things that surprised me when I first started doing this job is how many couples I saw that had been married like a year or less. I'm like, how can it go bad so fast, right? But what I found was they fixed it really quick, because they didn't have years of bad habits and bad patterns. But over years of doing this wrong, you can dig some pretty deep trenches that are pretty hard to climb out of, okay? And so they get into what we call a negative sentiment override, where I'm just looking at you negatively. And I don't know how you're going to irritate me today. I just know you are. So I don't even have to wait for you to do it. I'm just going to get irritated when you walk in the door. Save us all a lot of effort. Right? And it's really hard to turn that negative sentiment around, okay? When you first get married and you're newlyweds, you're just the opposite. You're in this positive sentiment. So, you know, then when he comes home an hour late, you hug him and you kiss him because he's alive, and, oh, I thought you were dead. You know, a couple years later, it's like inconsiderate bum, right? So, positive sentiment override. So the ratio is 5 positives to 1 negative. It takes 5 positives to outdo 1 negative. And that's if it's a minor negative, right? So here's the problem. We tend to keep what's called a ledger of merit. So I'm constantly kind of evaluating how you're treating me, okay? And as long as you're treating me pretty good, more good than bad, we're kind of balanced. But if all of a sudden I think you're kind of treating me badder and more bad and more bad and not too many good, all of a sudden I start feeling entitled to treat you bad so we can even it back out, okay? So inside we kind of keep score. Right? And I've treated you a whole lot better than you've treated me, which we all say, because I've seen it through my lens. Right? And so you got to be careful, because you don't know what your spouse's ledger is. You don't know what the score is. You don't know what the tally is. And so you've got to really work hard to keep it positive, because we're never sure where that balance is. But you want to stay in a positive sentiment, a positive expectation. And so one of the exercises I do with some of my couples is I say, okay, write down all the things that are bad about your spouse and write down all the things that are good. Well, when they finally do it, they really do it, the list of the good stuff is a lot longer than the list of the bad stuff. Okay. So, keep a positive sentiment. Okay. Okay, I want to leave a little time for some questions. Last thing I'll say. One of the things that's really predictive, I got two more things to say. One of the things that's really predictive of marital happiness is when you accept influence from each other, when you allow your spouse to influence you. Especially predictive of happiness when the husband allows himself to be influenced by the wife. Okay? And what the statistic is, when men accept influence from their wife, 81% of those men label their marriage as very happy. Okay, and when they don't, there's a much higher likelihood of divorce. Okay, so men, just to allow your wife to influence you is very important. Last thing I'll say.
What's an example of that? I'm not quite sure what influence means.
So it could be as simple as which movie we're going to go see, or, you know, what time bedtime should be, or, you know, what color we should paint the walls, or anytime you're having a conversation about something, you have a difference of opinion, allowing your wife to carry the day generally equates to a very happy marriage. Okay. All right, when I first met the work, the priest who I met with, Father Dick Shen, I don't know if you know Father Dick Shen. He was a man's priest. The women didn't like him so much, but the first time I went to confession, he cussed at me. I won't tell you what he said, but I was like, whoa, I think I like him. He told me I was full of something. I don't remember what it was. But he said, Doug, hey, if it ain't a sin, give in. Whoa, that makes it kind of easy, doesn't it? It's like, yeah, you can't compromise an area of sin. But other than that, what difference does it make if the room's pink and purple? Give it in. Okay, Father Dick, thank you. Don't say that to my wife, though. So that's the deal. All right, so accepting influence. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. The last thing is, and this comes, and all the stuff I'm talking about is based on research. And the leading researcher is this guy named John Gottman. And so it's this is not just like after 39 years of marriage, a lot of gray hair, I figured it out. This is all based on research and science. One of the things that Gottman discovered was couples throughout the course of the day make what he calls a bid for connection. You'll just throw out something. You'll say something or do something that's pretty meaningless, but I just want to connect with you. So I'll just say, hey, did you see where the cardinals build a nest in our tree in the backyard? No. I didn't. And you don't really want to have a conversation about birds or nests or cardinals. You just want to connect, right? Or, you know, hey, what do you want to have for breakfast like Thursday? I don't know. It's Tuesday. I don't know. Right? Well, I'm going shopping. I just want to know if I should buy waffles. Or, you know. So it's not that you want to have these conversations. You just want to connect. You just want to connect, okay? What he found was that on these bids for connection, if the couple actually turns and looks at each other, 90% of the time or more, they have a 0% chance of divorce. None of those couples ever divorce. 30% or less, almost 100% chance of divorce. That one thing is very predictive of the health of the marriage. Because why? I only look at people who are important to me. And if I'm not looking at you, it's because you're not important to me anymore. So, a couple years ago, my wife and I were down in Paducah, Kentucky. It'd be up in Paducah, Kentucky for you all, but for me, it was down to Paducah. For the weekend, we were at a conference. Saturday night, needed to go get some dinner, pulled in a restaurant, walked in, lady said, 45-minute wait. I'm like, I don't want to wait 45 minutes. I've been waiting like 5 hours. She said, we have a table in the bar. I'm like, I don't want to sit in the bar. I'm out with my wife. I want to have a nice, quiet. She said, no, it's off to the side. It'll be fine. I'm like, okay, fine. So whenever we go to a restaurant, the first thing my wife does is she figures out where the TVs are. And she makes me sit so I can't see any of them. Because I'm easily distracted. All right? So she kind of sits me kind of, you know, right? But I can see the bar. And there's a young couple at the bar. And he's got his beer, she's got her glass of wine, ball game's on, she's got her phone, waitress comes, takes their order, food comes, they eat, they're talking to each other, but not once in the 45 minutes I watched them did they actually look at each other. And on the way out, I wanted to give them my card. And I wanted to say, you guys are in pretty deep trouble and you don't even know it, right? Because they didn't look up from their phone or from their TV. So the one thing I really want to encourage you to do, and I blew that pretty bad on the hot tea deal, didn't I? At 10 o'clock in the morning, I didn't turn and look at my wife. Now you better believe I do. So it's really predictive of the harmony in a marriage if you actually turn and look at each other, all right? So work on that, okay? Do this and work at looking at each other when you're making these bids for connection, okay? I think that's all I've got. That's it. That's all I got.
Any questions? Maybe.
No, he has to accept your influence. I'm sorry.
Frank, should we have him repeat it? So if you could repeat,
I'll repeat
the question.
Okay.
Of course.
Me?
Yeah.
When you're talking about stonewalling,
yes.
When someone says, when you figured out, like, the safe word, and they say to you, but then the next day or within an hour, they don't come back to you.
Yeah.
To have the conversation, and the next day, they don't bring it up.
Right.
And then you feel like you need to bring it up because it is something that's heavy on you.
Yeah.
And then they're just like, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
What do you do then?
Okay, so what do you do if you have a conflict going and one person stonewalls or shuts down and says, I'll come back in an hour, we'll address it the next day, but that person does not come back and address it again? What do you do, right? And I think you go back to general startup and you say, listen, I'm feeling now like I'm not important to you because you committed that we would resolve this issue and we haven't done it. Could we please talk about it now? Or can we please schedule a time to talk about it later, but a committed time, okay? And because what this takes is it takes cooperation on both parts. And one of the things that's very difficult for me as a marriage counselor is when one of the two won't come in for the session. So just the wife shows up or just the husband, right? And how do you... So I can work with them because if I got the husband's half, I can have the husband work on positive behaviors and controlling his negative emotions, so I can work on it. And since it's a closed system, if you change any one of the four variables, you change the system. So you can actually have a very positive impact on your marriage without your spouse even knowing what you're doing. But obviously it's better both are there because you can support each other. Okay. One other thing I would say, and certainly share this with your friends, trouble in marriage is a lot like cancer. The earlier you detect it, the greater the chances of a cure, okay? Statistically, from the time a couple says, man, we're in trouble, we should get some help, to the time they actually go get help is 6 years. And by that time, it's almost always too late. One of the two has died. And once you've died emotionally, you can't breathe life back into that corpse. I've got a couple I'm working with now, married 42 years. 37 years ago, he had an affair. She hasn't gotten over it in 37 years. And she is emotionally dead, and there's no way it's going to come back. And this guy's been as remorseful as could be, and, you know, she can't get over it. So it's not, I don't see any hope for that marriage. She's got to, she can't get there. So the deal is, get help right away. I mean, on my personal business card, I label myself a marriage coach. Because, I don't need a therapist. Yeah, I know, but who doesn't need a coach? Every pro golfer has a coach. Every athlete has a coach, right? Why not a marriage coach? What more important this job is there in the world than your marriage? Well, and you didn't get a bachelor's degree in it. You probably didn't take a single class in it. You probably didn't, maybe you had a weekend thing before you got married, right? So you've had very little training how to do it, but there's nothing more important. It's just kind of ball backwards, right? That's how it is. So anyway, but the sooner you get help, the better, before it gets, you know, too much pain. Yes?
My question is, how do you deal with an irrational spouse? Because all of this is very reasonable and rational, but if you have an irrational spouse, like, how do you deal with
it? Yeah, how do you deal with an irrational spouse? Yeah.
Fun to see on TV.
Present company accepted, right?
She doesn't watch TV, so.
Talking about your next door neighbor. Yeah, so it's hard, right? So what's really hard is, since we have free will, we can say, tackle it. I'm not going to try that hard. I'm not going to do it, you know? I mean, I've got a woman I'm working with now, and her husband won't come in. But he comes home from work, and he gets on his computer, plays computer games till dinner, and then he gets back on his computer till bedtime. She's expecting her third child. She gets absolutely no help. He expects her to keep working full time because he doesn't want to go get a tougher job than what he's got. And so how do you deal with that, right? I mean, this poor gal, I feel so bad for her. You know, she's in a tough place. Right, you're right. The whole deal is you both really want to make it work, and so you're willing to do what it takes. So it's hard to deal with an irrational spouse. And I guess to a degree, listen, there's a lot of martyrdom in marriage as well, right? And there's this 70% of the problems that aren't going to get fixed. Well, that's part of the cross that we all get to carry because we all married... Except for me, we all married a flawed person. My wife has very few flaws. I fixed her over the years. I did a lot of this, and it really paid off. Shaped her right up. But there's a certain amount of it that's just, you're martyrdom, right? And sometimes you can look at it as, what's the virtue God's trying to get me to grow in? with this spouse, with this person, with these defects? And how can I use my marriage to become a saint, you know, to really sanctify what's going on, even the tough times and the heartaches and stuff. You know?
Doug, one thing that I think is peripherally related, because you talked about breakdown of the family.
Yeah.
It's abortion. I know that's not your topic.
Yeah.
But the reason abortion is important is because most people think it's about babies, dead babies.
Yeah.
I don't think it's about dead babies. I think it's about getting women not wanting to be mothers and getting men not wanting to be fathers.
Yeah.
And once the devil does that, you've destroyed the family.
Yeah.
And you don't need any babies anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, we misdirect shooting at the... I mean, it's important to shoot at dead babies. Sorry, bad pun. But shoot at that issue.
Right.
But it's really about fatherhood and motherhood.
So the point is that the abortion thing really kind of tears apart motherhood and fatherhood in society. Is trying to destroy what it means to be a father and to be a mother, and I deal with those guilt issues sometimes with, you know, women who, I got a couple I'm working with. She got pregnant prom night senior year. They're like in their 50s now, but she got pregnant prom night, had an abortion a couple months later, and then went on, and 5 or 6 years later got married. She's got 3 kids, but she still hasn't quite forgiven herself for that abortion, right? And it's a terribly difficult, painful thing, for sure.
Would you say that there's a limit to the gentle startup, that there's a time that you should say, yeah, I feel, but I shouldn't feel this way, so drop it?
Tough enough. So is there a limit to gentle startup?
Because if I bring every little thing, you know,
but if you bring every little thing, it gets solved before it builds up. Well, but right, so there's a reasonable person standard, right? You know, you're walking down the street and a pretty girl walks by and you look at her and your wife says, you're having an affair. I can tell. Right, so there's a reasonable standard there, right? But your feelings are your feelings. And even if they're a little unreasonable, they're still there. Now, maybe if they're really unreasonable, then you should go see a professional who can say, okay, let me kind of bring you back into some sort of balance here of reasonableness. But I think try to do too much of this. Try to do it too often, really. It no bad will come out of this, I don't think. As long as you start with this.
He doesn't do it at all. That's a big
right, so. The journey of 1,000 miles starts with 1 step. Right. And you feel resentful. You feel unloved.
Don't forget the gentle.
Yeah. Remember the gentle part.
How could a couple move from these 4 horsemen, say, practice that they have fallen into starting these nice,
right,
gentle
steps? Right. So how can you move away from the 4 horsemen into the gentle startup? What has to happen is you have to give each other permission to call it out when the horseman shows up. So when that horse rides in the room and you climb on, you got to give each other permission to say, wait a minute, you're stonewalling. Wait a minute, that's criticism. And you got to say, all right, let me back that off. Let me find a different way to say it. So you've got, and that's where safety is important. So you've got, we're in this thing together, right? And now listen, you just got defensive. Well, you're right, I did, because I have a right to be. But no, okay, thank you. Let me find a different way to come at this thing. Help me understand more deeply where you're coming from on this issue, okay? So you got to just call it out, like you know, spinach. You got to call it out, and you got to say, okay, thank you. Let me find a different way to say it.
Okay. You may have already answered this in just talking about, you know, 70% of the conflicts aren't going to get resolved.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that a lot of problems come when you get to number 3, and the other person, probably both people at different times, doesn't want to do what you ask, you know, what you're please asking them to do. It's like, well, I think that's unreasonable, or, you know.
Right, right. Okay, so what happens when you do the gentle startup and you get down to number 3 where you ask your spouse to do something and they say, I'm not going to do that, okay? I on the surface, I say, well, that's kind of bad faith, right? You ought to accept influence from your wife, right? But on the other hand, that maybe it's part of that 70% where I just can't do it for whatever reason. Then that's just part of that 70% that just isn't going to get fixed, and you're just going to have to live with that thing, right? And it's amazing to me, the scars we have from childhood that come with us, right? And It's just amazing. And, you know, I've got couples who, they get roadblocked, but because of something that happened when they were 10 years old, and they just can't get past it. There's a lot more, you know, molestation out there, child molestation, than what you tend to think there is. And coming out of, you know, some amazing families too, but there's an uncle, there's a neighbor, there's something. So sometimes I just can't get past this thing because of these scars I've got. So then it's part of that 70%. Yeah. Yeah.
How come when you can't sit to watch any of the TV programs, I mean, screens, why doesn't that feel like criticism to you?
Say that again.
You know, your wife, you said she won't, she seats me, so I won't be looking at any of the screens.
Oh, yeah, right.
Why doesn't that feel like criticism?
Okay, so when my wife won't let me look at all the TV screens, why isn't that criticism? Well, because what she's saying is, I love you. I know you. You're easily distracted, and especially if it's a sporting event. And I just want you to be able to focus strictly on me. And I appreciate that because I agree that I have this defect. If there's a TV with a sporting event on, I'm going to look at it. And I don't want to because I want to look at her. So I acknowledge the fact that, yeah, that's a problem I've got. And she's helping me with the solution. Yeah. All right, so the last thing I'll say is marriages seldom explode in midair. Most of them die slow, imperceptible deaths, okay? It's like an airplane, right? On your wedding day, you're at 30,000 feet, right? And you drop to 29,999, 98, 97. You don't know, you're not noticing. Life's getting in the way. Jobs, careers, houses, bills, kids, but you're taking your eye off of each other, right? And every once in a while, your ears pop, and you're like, whoa, something happened. You can go up and check the cockpit and find out you're at 25,000 feet, or you can go back to reading your book, right? A lot of times couples go back to reading their book because they don't want to deal with the conflict. They just keep going. And then at some point the kids move out and you're out of altitude and you just crash. The divorce rate goes up in the 60s because we haven't spent any time on date night and those kinds of things. We've just slowly drifted apart without realizing it. And then all of a sudden there's no altitude left. So, which is why things like date night, staying in a positive sentiment, some of the things I'll talk to the men about tomorrow are so important to keep the marriage up to altitude, okay? So don't let it die a slow death. That's all I got.
You can hear Doug by podcast on, so he's interviewed.
Right? Oh.
Well, he's interviewed on the radio program On the Front Porch.
On Relevant Radio. Generally, it's the first Saturday.
I tried to look you up on podcasts. There's a lot of weird stuff that comes up if you do Doug Hinderer.
Is that right?
On podcast, yes. But then you get Hinderer and others. All kinds. But if you Google Doug Hinderer, Relevant Radio,
yeah,
then you'll get it.
Is that right?
You'll get his interviews, and it's usually the first 20 minutes.
Usually the first Saturday. Right? It's usually at 10 o'clock. They used to be half-hour segments. Now they're 20-minute segments.
But there's actually a web podcast that is called podcast? The Morning Show.
On the front porch.
Is the Welcome Ringer program.
There's a podcast with
Patrick McCormick.
Oh, yeah.
Patrick McCormick. And we do a little, usually a half-hour little interview, generally first Saturday of each month.
And I'm sure Doug will be happy to answer any more personal questions. But thanks for coming. And dads, if you want to come tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. Mass in the chapel, followed by an excellent breakfast at 8:45, talk in this room at 9:15 over 10:15, 10:30.
Yeah, cool.
So,
all right.
Thank you, Doug.
You're welcome.